Sego, I'm John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio. I want to thank you for joining me. As Reggie previously mentioned, and as we mentioned on almost every program here, we are listener-supported radio, and we count on your contributions to this station, to these stations, I should say, to keep us on the air. And oftentimes, look, we are community-supported radio. We don't have, you know, big corporate sponsors. We don't have advertisers, and we don't get a whole, we aren't federally funded. So we rely entirely on you. So that puts us under the gun sometimes. And more often than not, we are behind on at some level with the various costs of operating these stations. So I implore you to support WBAI and WPFW, the two stations that have granted me the opportunity to have access to their airtime. And it is important as a native person. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, land back, and we hear, you know, a lot of, sometimes almost self-serving land acknowledgements. Well, I'll tell you, as I've said before, land acknowledgements don't do it for me. We need space. We need land. We need land back. We need airtime. We need column inches. We need the kind of things. And again, some of what I talk about is just this: an hour on the radio in New York City and Washington, D.C. So it's not a gift, though. Yeah, I got to tell you, it'd be great if WPFW and WBAI just said, you know what? We think it's so important to have a native show on this on the air that we're not going to ask you to do any heavy lifting. We're not going to ask you to fundraise, but that's not the case. It's the burden's on me as it is with everybody. So I ask you, the listener, to support WBAI and to support WPFW. So let me start off by giving the pledge lines. For WBAI, the pledge line is 212-209-2950. Let me say that again a little slower. 212-209-2950. Or you can go online to give2wbai.org. If you are listening in Washington, D.C., the pledge line there is 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. Or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. You can also type in /donate, but you can follow the prompts to get there. And look, I say that if you're listening in New York, if you're listening in Washington, but if you're listening anywhere, we stream the show live on Facebook. We put it up as a podcast. And of course, for those of you who follow this show, you probably know that I do another podcast called Let's Talk Native, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that today, as a matter of fact, because of an important issue that relates to a show that I just did up in Mohawk territory. But this is what I do. You know, I'm a voice, I'm a platform, I'm an opportunity for Native and non-Native people to hear not just news, but a pulse of what's happening in our communities. And you may not hear this anywhere else. And, you know, that's not to begrudge other broadcasters or other platforms, other podcasts. Look, there are some great voices out there. But I know that I'm probably, I don't attempt to be an outlier, but I know a lot of what I'm saying here, you're not hearing anywhere else. So, look, I'm still going to acknowledge the, you know, special days and special occasions and special events. Like other podcasters or broadcasters do. But I'm oftentimes going to probably give a little bit different spin on some things. So I can't do it without your support. So again, please support WBAI and WPFW. And again, even if you don't listen to us on the radio, maybe you listen to us as a podcast. Maybe you listen to us as a Facebook a viewer and you catch the videos and the audio there. But regardless of how you listen, we are, this program, Resistance Radio, is radio. So if we want to remain on radio, we need you to support it. So, all right, let me get into it. For those of you who can't see, I'm wearing my Missing and Murdered Indigenous shirt today, Indigenous women's shirt, I'm sorry, because in a couple of days, on Sunday, I know some of you say, well, isn't that Cinco de Mayo? Well, not for us. It is... It's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Awareness Day. And it's not just about women. It's about girls. It's about, you know, teens. It's about indigenous people who just turn up missing at a much higher rate than anybody else. But to put the emphasis on women, our women experience sexual assault at a rate that far surpasses anybody else. And, you know, some of it's domestic violence, some of it isn't. And some of it, you know, is frankly at the hands of Native people. But the vast majority of violence against Native women comes from non-Native men. And these things are not investigated. I was just listening to a story the other day about how there is no policing available to even police non-Native people committing crimes against Native people. Unless it's a serious, serious crime. Unless it's, you know, a blatant murder and you know for a fact that it's a homicide. There's no FBI resources. They're scarce in many places. We just don't rate. We don't rate. And heaven forbid, and I use that sarcastically, that Native people would actually take defending our people into our own hands. So we get stuck in a place. Although I will say categorically, we should take defending our people and defending our territories into our own hands. And I say, let somebody challenge us for having done that. Look, who's that clown? Reggie, if you're available, who's that clown that killed Trayvon Martin? Was it
Zimmerman. George Zimmerman,
yeah. If that moron could play neighborhood watch and kill this teenager and get away with it, I damn sure know that we can defend our women on our territories. So, you know, whether the outside law enforcement wants to get involved or not, we need to get involved. And I say, you know, the hell with, you know, I throw a little caution to the wind. I'm not saying that I'm advocating violence. I'm advocating defense. So, but anyway, that's, I told you I've got to always give a little bit different angle on this whole missing and murdered indigenous women thing. So, again, really concerned about the violence against our women, against our girls. I mean, we're talking about everything from the human trafficking to, you know, again, to domestic violence. So it goes across the board, and Native women in particular. I always have to remind people, Reg, you remember when Gabby Petito was, when she was in the news? And look, I'm not going to diminish the horrors that this pretty little blonde girl experienced. Nor am I criticizing her for being a pretty little blonde girl. But she was on the news every single day, on every broadcast of every single day for over a week. And of course, the worst case scenario came to be true regarding her circumstance. She was murdered by her boyfriend, and we all feel bad about that. But you know what else I feel bad about? The half dozen to a dozen Native women who were missing at the same time from the same area that never once got on, was never once mentioned on the news. Never once. And it's still not mentioned. So, I mean, unless we have a Native person who is a famous actor or a star, or an athlete perhaps, just a run-of-the-mill Native person, especially a Native woman, is never, and look, I'll say the same thing about a black woman. I mean, but in this situation, our women are turning up missing at a higher rate than anybody. Our women, right along with women, black women, die even giving birth to a child, the most natural thing in the world, die at double the rate of a white woman. And it's not because we have a predisposition for having dangerous births. So while we talk about missing and murdered indigenous women, I'm not just talking about the ones who went missing or the ones who were murdered. We have women and men dying at a rate that is just inexcusable, and it's only you can't ignore the racial component here. I mean, you just can't. Our men die in death by cop at a higher rate than black people. And I'm not saying that is like for bragging rights. I mean, I will say that black men in that 16 to 22 demographic exceed as a percentage of our population, I'm not talking about total numbers here, I'm talking about a percentage of our population, but we die at a higher rate for our population than anybody in the USA or Canada by cop. You can only, there's no logical explanation other than racism. And I know there's always somebody clutching their pearls when I say that. So, but somebody can come up with another, explanation, I'm willing to hear it. But I guarantee that explanation will ultimately reduce down to some sort of U.S. policy that has, you know, some sort of race-based agenda to it. So on May 5th, while many people, you know, and frankly, many Native people will be celebrating Cinco de Mayo, we're also trying to raise awareness about the plight of our women in particular, but the whole disproportionate level of death that that Native people experience while it continues to go unnoticed. And I know, they look, Deb Haaland is the Interior Secretary, and she threw some nice words out there, and they're going to throw a couple of million dollars here and a couple of million dollars there, and that just gets swallowed up in bureaucracy. It doesn't change anything. But, you know, I'm not saying I don't want more resources, but the resources have to be meaningful. And you know what? It isn't just enough money or just enough to throw money at the idea. There has to be policy changes. We've got to stop advocating this notion that we should be fetishized. That's the whole mascot issue. That's why I've been fighting the damn mascot issue. It's not just about putting Warriors or Redskins. No, what do you think? How do you think men come to fetishize Native women the way they do? It's Hollywood. It's television. It's all that stuff. It's dressing up your cheerleaders in little Pocahontas outfits. It's lying about Pocahontas. It's about all of that. So there has to be a bigger shift to change this. This isn't just about throwing money at more cops or more FBI agents who aren't going to do a damn thing anyway. It has to be bigger than that. So that's what I wanted to say today. I know other podcasters, other radio show hosts are going to talk about this Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Awareness Day. But that's my 2 cents. And you know, I'm doing more than 2 cents. This is an issue that I've talked about plenty of times on the show. I mean, look, my shirt design, this is actually a flag that I designed, you know, that I hoped maybe they could start taking some of those POW, MIA POW flags down that, to me, I don't know why they fly on Native territories the way they do. It's not like we've got this, our missing population isn't missing in, as POW someplace. They're missing in Wyoming. They're missing in Oklahoma. They're missing around every major city that Native people have to gravitate to try to even earn an income. Yeah, our people who are missing in action aren't because they're listed in the armed forces. So take the damn MIA POW flags down and let's fly a couple of missing and murdered Indigenous women flags. That's what I say. Like I said, told you I was going to tell you something nobody else was going to say. All right, now here's the other subject I got to talk about. Last Saturday, I went up to the Mohawk territory of Akwesasne. And I went up there to sit in on a couple of meetings happening. Actually, I've been doing it for a couple of weeks. And the reason is because, and I think I mentioned this last week, so I'm going to mention it again. There is a land claim settlement that the tribal council, which is the St. Regis Mohawk tribe, and the band council, which is like the Canadian version of a tribal council, which is the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne. They used to call them the Canadian St. Regis. I don't know, but anyway. So these are the two Canadian recognized government and the federally recognized government in Akwesasne. Now, Akwesasne, for those who aren't familiar, straddles the U.S. and Canadian border. So while my people, the people that I'm associated with, the Longhouse people, don't recognize that Canadian border, the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne does, the St. Regis Tribe of Mohawks do, and so, of course, does the, you know, all the other jurisdictions around there. So why does the band council and the tribal council have a different disposition on all this? Well, I'll tell you, because they are essentially arms of the Canadian and federal government. They are funded by the U.S. government and the Canadian government. They get really the bulk of their authority comes from being federally recognized. It's not coming from the people. And they've been pushing the land claims for a number of years. Now, the Longhouse, and there's two Longhouses in Akwesasne. There's the Longhouse that I'm a part of, which, for lack of a better description, they call themselves the Great Law Longhouse, or the Gayana Lagoa. It doesn't really translate to Great Law, but they call themselves the Gayana Lagoa Longhouse. The other one is a little bit more along the lines of what people call the Gariwiyo, or the Code of Handsome Lake Longhouse. Now, and I'm not saying that to be derogatory towards one or the other, but that's kind of the split between the two longhouses. And it hasn't always been a split up there. It's something that, you know, happened coming out of, you know, several decades ago. But both longhouses have always maintained a position against settling land claims wherein a settlement involves getting cash and extinguishing some portion of a land claim. And I got to be careful here, because these aren't our land claims, because it's our land. It's the claim that these municipalities and the counties in New York State, they are the one claiming our land. We aren't claiming their land. So, I mean, it's kind of a false name, I guess, to even call them quote unquote Indian land claims. But there we have it. So there are several parcels of land that the Mohawk community, the Gunjagahaga community of Akwesasne, has lost, I would say, control over. And some of that came because of fraudulent leases. Can you picture a lease for 99 years? I mean, it almost seems like, well, how could that even be legal? I mean, who could enforce a lease for 99 years? Well, that's one of the ways that we were swindled a lot of land. But you know what was even worse? Some of these leases were for 999 years. Can you imagine a lease for 1 year shy of 1,000 years? I mean, a country that's only existed for a couple of hundred, and yet we, you know, their country, your country, you know, kind of authorized and acknowledged and accepted that these leases for 99 years and for 999 years were somehow legit. And of course, or I should say, of course they did. And why would they? Well, because they didn't expect us to be here at the end of that lease term. I mean, they were doing everything in their power to eliminate us, to move us away, move us off our lands, to extinguish our presence in our homelands. Because when you sever that tie between a native person and the land that they are connected to, it has a devastating effect. And that is why within the borders of New York State, or the proximity of the borders of New York State, we've always fought for our lands in a way that's different. By and large, and I would say 99% of all territories that most people would recognize as a reservation or quote-unquote Indian country, our lands, they were ours, but they became transferred to the federal government, and then the federal government says, we're going to hold it in trust for you. So they become trust lands. Now, I've talked about trust before, and not trust is a virtue, but what this is, which is, we think you're too incompetent, so we're going to take your land and we're going to hold it for you. And we're going to make certain promises that it's never not going to be your land, which isn't necessarily true, because we've had highways and we've had dams, we've had floodplains, we've had any number of things that have been done to our lands over the years that have denied us or deprived us of our lands. So most, and I got to say, this is true on the Canadian side too. They call them crown lands or trust lands held by the crown. Because even though Canada is a distinct country from Great Britain, it's still considered a British Commonwealth. So, again, understanding that we do something different here. We hold the title to our lands. We hold it as original title. They like to call it restricted fee. That's what the government calls it. They say, because fee is some sort of European or British standard for describing title, I guess. So they call it restricted fee. We call it original title. Now, when they call it restricted fee, here's one of the interesting things. They call it restricted fee because They claim we are restricted from selling to anybody but them. Now, in real estate, they call that like a first right of refusal or buying some sort of underlying, you know, title to a land should you be divested of that land. But that's usually something that has a price tag to it. No, not the United States. They did this through the doctrine of Christian discovery. So even though we kind of undermine the notion of the doctrine of discovery, which says that we don't hold title land, even when we hold title land, they slip a little bit of that doctrine of discovery in there and say, you hold the title, but you can't sell it to anybody but us. And they also try to say, you can't sell it to states, you can't sell it to individuals, you can only sell it to the federal government. Of course, they've walked all over that provision over the years. So there's the language associated with title. Now, the problem with land claim settlements is even when we get land back, they have these nebulous words. They say, well, it'll revert back to reservation status. What the hell is reservation status? For one thing, that's not even our word. I mean, we kept our lands, or at least some small portion of our lands. Our lands are not lands that the government reserved for us, which is where that notion of a reservation comes from. Now, I'm not saying that word didn't get used out here, amongst the Haudenosaunee or Haudenosaunee, but it's not really our word. It's not really our concept. But when they say it'll revert back to reservation status or Indian country status, those are not even legal definitions. You want to get into definitions, you got to talk about title. Who holds the title? And who issues the title? And these tribal counselors, nah, they're not even going to get into any of that. You know, at the end of the day, land that comes back, they're going to fight for who has control over the land from a tribal council or a band council standpoint. Who is the governing authority over? That's their concern. Not whether it comes back as original title to the Gunyagahag or to the Mohawk people. No, that's not their concern. They're saying, well, who's federally recognized? If it comes back on the Canadian side, the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne will be the governing authority over that land. If it comes back on the American side, the St. Regis Mohawk tribe will say that. Well, what about the two longhouses? Because we don't necessarily subscribe to that notion that these band councils or tribal councils have this kind of legitimate authority. We've only ever viewed them as the administrators for funding that comes into a Native territory. We don't even view them as legitimate governments. Not with governing authority based on what? Federal recognition? So let me get into some of the problems with this land claim that is being and they already have a settlement agreement. They have an MOU with the state, and they have all this stuff worked out. First off, what the St. Regis Mohawk tribe did is they stopped making their revenue sharing payments, their gaming revenue sharing payments, which should never be tied to land claims as far as I'm concerned. Because, for one thing, I don't think they should be paying it anyway. In fact, one of the provisions on here in the land claims MOU is that they will make all their payments and make them timely. And they'll make the payments to the towns and to the counties and everything. And they're going to make additional payments as a part of they're going to pay. They're going to pay for their own land claim settlement. And I got to tell you, this was a strategy a long time ago. With the Oneida case, and we're going back decades and decades ago, there was the belief as the Oneidas began to enter into gaming, they said, you know what? This ain't a bad thing. We can make the Oneidas pay for their own land claims. And guess what? They did. They did it. And that's what's going to happen here. And of course, there's this ominous threat that if you for whatever reason breach this revenue sharing payment, then the state is going to eliminate the exclusivity they've given you. Let me tell you something. Akwesasne, in spite of the pollution that they've had to endure and some of the environmental damage that's been done to the St. Lawrence River and all the lands that they live on, it's beautiful. But you know what? It's not exactly the greatest hub of tourism. So the fact that they've got a casino up there, it makes money. And I'm not saying it doesn't make money. But the idea that New York State says, well, we're going to make you pay a percentage of your revenue, so we'll come to the table. And they're not supposed to be able to do this. And I've talked about this with Seneca, but same thing with Mohawk Territory. We're gonna pressure you to offer revenue sharing payments to us in exchange for exclusivity. Who the hell is going to build a casino to compete with the Mohawk Territory in the North Country? I mean, there is nobody in their right mind who's going to take $500 million. First off, $500 million just to get a license from New York State. Then another $500 million to build some luxury casino in the North Country? Ain't going to happen. Never going to. And you know what? Anybody who would do that is going to lose anyway. Look, the state gave a license to a company to put a casino right on the thruway just outside of the so-called exclusivity zone of the Seneca Nation, and they haven't even been able to pay for it. They actually have to pay interest-only payments for the financing of building the casino. And I don't know how long it's been up. It's been up since, damn, I want to say 1987, and they still can't generate enough revenue to pay down the principal on their finance charges. So competing against us isn't exactly wise, and especially when you consider that most of our territories, and the Senecas are a little bit different because we do have, here we do have a gaming site in Buffalo and one in Niagara Falls, and then one of them on the edge of one of our territories. But this notion that somehow the state has this ominous threat amongst the St. Regis Mohawk Tribal Council of building a casino in their backyard, It's absolutely absurd. It's absolutely absurd. All right, so let me talk a little bit more about the settlement agreement. For one thing, it doesn't include all of the land. There's actually a parcel of land in what is considered the city of Messina. They call it the Messina Mile. That's not even in this. That's not even in this group. And ironically, some native people, look, we didn't wait for this land claim. Yeah, up in Akwesasne, there are native people who have bought land in every one of these disputed areas. And it's not even, well, take it back. In every one of these areas that they know is Mohawk land. Two guys have shops in Messina, in this area, selling cannabis. And Messina's trying to sue them. The city of Messina, their district attorney, whatever, is trying to bring charges and bring a suit against the two Mohawk operators of cannabis shops saying, oh, they're violating state law. Well, state law doesn't apply on our land. Yeah, but as far as we're concerned, as long as the courts are saying that land is Messina, we're going to hold you to Messina law or whatever, state law or whatever. So there are people that have bought land. And in all the other claim areas, there are people who've lived there for years. So, and they aren't going to pay. They haven't been paying taxes. In fact, the counties don't even try to assess taxes on some of these parcels anymore. So this land claim settlement is going to include those areas too. But think about it. If you're Longhouse and you bought some of this property, are you going to want that land, whether it's trust or even restricted fee, whatever status they negotiate for how that land's going to be titled? Do you want the St. Regis tribe to not only hold that title, but to be the governing authority? We're in a constant state of conflict with the tribe and the band council from Longhouse to their authority. And in fact, I keep mentioning that that it's these two band council and tribal council. Well, here's what happened. Remember I told you there's two Longhouses? Well, both Longhouses have always been opposed to this idea of selling out or extinguishing claims. But they've managed to utilize a couple of people. And I'm not even going to throw the other Longhouse under a bus here. But they've managed to somehow entice, I guess, or I don't know, co-opt some of the more recognizable people from the other Longhouse. Not the one that I attend, the one that's considered more of a Handsome Lake Longhouse. And I don't want to throw that term out there to sound like that's what I'm condemning. I'm condemning that this individual is now being used by the MCA, the band council, and the tribal council. It's being used to be the lead on this thing. See, now here's the problem, though. And this is the BIA, the Interior Department, isn't directly involved in this. But ultimately, this settlement is going to require an act of Congress, because otherwise it can only have land come through the trust process, which it will have some of that. But this is a settlement being negotiated between the state of New York, the two counties, Franklin and St. Lawrence County, and the New York Power Authority, which is a whole nother story. And ultimately, this is supposed to go through and have Congress ratify this settlement. But the Interior Department, they've always had a policy about what they would acknowledge as a legitimate, quote-unquote, tribal referendum. They said, we can't sanction or ratify or whatever you want to do, condone or whatever, approve a referendum that doesn't have at least a 30% participation. Now, 30% is not high, especially for the fact that these band councils and tribal councils hold all this leverage over their so-called band members. So what they've said, if you're going to hold a referendum, we can't really sign off on that referendum unless you have 30% participation. These guys have had nowhere near that. I think the St. Regis Tribal Council, they did a referendum, and I'll tell you when in a minute, but they did a referendum, and they had about 1,000 people vote out of 16,000. I mean, that's like just barely above 6%. Doesn't even approach 10% participation. And the numbers on the Canadian side, the MCA side, the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne side, it's an even smaller number. I don't know what they claimed their overall population, so I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a significantly smaller number. So they had these pitiful turnouts for these land claim referendum, and they were 20 freaking years ago. 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. I mean, think about that. The vast majority, or a large segment of the population that even voted for these things, because it's usually the older ones that vote, not the younger ones that vote. A large percentage of the population that voted 20 years ago are dead. They're not even around. And now we have an emerging population of younger people who might weigh in on something like this. I'm not saying they would vote. I'm not saying they would vote, because we don't vote. It's not our way. It's not our system. So they're going to try to push through with their documents that this land claim settlement was approved by a referendum 20 freaking years ago, by a minuscule percentage of their population. So that's what the MCA, the band council and the tribal council, do. What about the Longhouse? How does the Longhouse prove to the state of New York or the federal government, the Interior Department, if they weigh in? Because they sent a letter. The Interior Department sent a letter. You know, we see that there was a reference. We see that there's a process for the band council and the tribal council. Although, for whatever reason, they aren't questioning the participation, the threshold for participation, nor the fact that it's 20 years ago. But they said, what about the Longhouse? What's the Longhouse going to do to verify that its membership has approved this? Well, it ain't going to happen through a referendum, because that's not our system, and we don't vote. I mean, there are probably many people that carry a band card or a tribal card for the St. Regis Tribe or the band council on the Canadian side that are Longhouse. They'd only carry that card for like insurance or something like that, so they can be seen at the clinic. They aren't carrying that card because they're loyal to those governments, and they won't vote in their elections for chiefs or whatever they call them when they get elected. And they sure as hell aren't going to vote in a land claim referendum, because they will not be a part, whether winners or losers, they will not be a part of sanctioning a referendum on land claims. Why? Because Longhouse people are opposed to these kinds of settlements. You want to give the underlying title? That doesn't need a referendum. What needs a referendum is when we say, okay, you're going to give us money and we're going to extinguish any future claim. That requires a referendum, as far as the federal government is concerned. And it should be as far as the band council is concerned. But, you know, the Longhouse could document their process and say, well, we don't do votes. We operate through the Gayunaragoa, so we operate through the clan system that approves, and we come to a consensus based on the three sides of our Longhouse and that kind of stuff. And I could do a whole show on that, but I'm not going to do that. But we have a different process for reaching consensus other than 50% plus one rules over 50% minus one. That's not a system that we endorse, but that's what the band councils use, the tribal council uses. So, I mean, the longhouse that is being dragged into this land claim settlement could say, well, we passed it through our longhouse on such and such a date, and all three sides, all nine families of the Mohawk Nation came to a consensus in agreement. But they can't, because they haven't. They haven't put this thing through the clan system. They haven't done this thing through a longhouse process. So they can't say, well, we've got a resolution that came from our longhouse, and it's you have to accept this as the permission, because we don't do referendum. But they can't even do that, because there are people in the other longhouse who are absolutely opposed to this. They just don't know how to deal with this idea that their longhouse may be being used by the tribal council and band council. They don't want to jump up and remove their chief. And there's also this whole anti-warrior, anti-gaming, anti-this, anti-that, anti-cannabis part of the other longhouse that doesn't want to. They almost don't want to agree too much with the longhouse that I participate in. But by and large, they are in agreement. They just don't want to have to use a process that requires removing one of their loved personnel. So it's a real problem. To make a long story short, which I've already made it a long story, so I'm not going to make it short, there is no way to verify that the Mohawk people, whether they are card-carrying band members of the band council, card-carrying tribal members of the tribal council, or whether they are, they find their allegiances to either one of the longhouses. There's no way that any entity, not this Mohawk Nation Council from the longhouse, he can't verify it, neither can the band council or the tribal council, that the Mohawk people have approved this. And they've been doing this for over 20 years. There's been agreements and memorandum of understanding. There's been all these things that have happened. But you can't prove that the people have supported this thing. So, and again, part of the big issue here is that even as they talk about lands that may or may not come back or revert back to reservation status, they aren't necessarily properly enumerating through any of their documentation how much of this land is going to be left out. And how much land is going to have that claim from our people extinguished through this deal? Because there is money. There's like $70 million that's going to change hands. And that's going to be divided up amongst this, what they call it, the tri-council. The band council, the tribal council, and this longhouse council that isn't really operating as a complete longhouse council. So it's like I said, it's complicated. So like I said, I've been going up for a couple of weeks to address this issue and to be included in the conversation. And there was a desire from some of the folks in the longhouse that I go to that I go up and I do a broadcast. So I did a podcast live from Akwesasne last Saturday. You can find it on my YouTube channel, which is Let's Talk Native TV, or you can find the podcast of it by going to Let's Talk Native with John Cain podcast. I post it on SoundCloud, but it goes out on all the podcast platforms. And of course, we streamed live the event, and it's over an hour and a half long, so it's not a short thing. But Paul Delarone, Degarundage, my friend, was a part of this thing, and we did it live from Akwesasne. We had a little bit of a glitch with the audio in the beginning of the Facebook live stream. We fixed it on the YouTube video. So if you want to watch the video, I would advise you to watch it on YouTube, not on Facebook. But you can certainly hear the conversation. About 20 minutes of it had a little bit of a challenge to the audio, but the other hour and 20 minutes was fine. So, but we did this podcast, and I got to tell you, for issues that sometimes feel like there's just overwhelming apathy, we had close to 4,000 people listen to the podcast or watch it on Facebook. We also had the audio simulcast on at least one radio station on one native territory called Tandanega. So the conversation that that Begarundagay and I had on last Saturday, and basically my call to say, look, you got to get involved in this thing. And this isn't just an Akwesasne deal. This is a isn't even just a Mohawk Nation deal. It's a Confederacy deal. So if you're Mohawk or if you're just Haudenosaunee or Haudenosaunee, you should be paying attention to this. Because the extinguishing of a land claim has a ripple effect on other parcels of land and on other people. You know, we grow concerned about a community like the Ganyange. I've never really done, well, I guess I have done a show, but I should do a fully dedicated show to Ganyange. Ganyange is a territory that we took back. I mean physically took back. In much the way, same way that individuals in Akwesasne have physically taken back the lands in some of these disputed, so-called disputed areas. But no, Ganyange exists, and it was a settlement for what Ganyange is today was negotiated with Mario Cuomo, even before he was governor. I think he was the lieutenant governor or attorney general or I don't know, whatever he was before he was the governor. But he negotiated this. And some of my friends were the ones at the negotiating table. And so Ganyange exists. It's a small Native community near Plattsburgh. They've got a bingo hall and they've got a couple of shops. And, you know, they've sustained themselves. They get no federal funding. But there's always this dispute. Well, what are they? Well, as far as the Mohawk people of Ganyange are concerned, it's a Mohawk community. It's always been Mohawk land. But what the state did was they said, well, we got to figure out how we can paper this. So a land trust was set up at the state level. And the Mohawks say, you do what you got to do. But we aren't going to be a party to a land trust. So it's a group of upstanding American citizens, some from churches and stuff like that, who are the directors on this trust and this land trust. And so as far as New York State is concerned, legally it's a land trust, but they also recognize that it's a Mohawk community. And the concern with any of these extinguishing land claims is where does it leave a place like Ganyange? Where does it leave a territory that may not have their land as secured as a territory that's got, you know, 10,000 people on it? You know, and that, you know, that represents a concern. So doing this one right matters. And I got to compare. And I did this when I did the podcast last Saturday. The Seneca Nation had a situation, and I've talked about their situation a little bit before, but they had a situation where a parcel of land was leased from them for 99 years. And that lease came due in like 1990. And it involved the city of Salamanca. So a municipality, a state municipality, was located on Seneca land, the Seneca Allegheny territory of the Seneca Nation. And they leased it from the Senecas. And of course, they grossly underpaid for it. But when the lease came due at 99 years, what they tried to say, what the state and the counties and everybody else that was claiming Salamanca as theirs, said, well, that lease was like a sale. No, it wasn't. Just because you tried to screw us for 99 years doesn't mean it was like a sale. It was still a lease, and we're still here. You didn't plan on it, but we're still here. So they had to come up with a settlement on how the city of Salamanca would continue, and there was an argument that the Senecas had gotten screwed. They hadn't gotten paid right for this thing. So the Salamanca Lease Settlement Act resulted in, I think, both state and local funds putting a settlement number together for like $60 million. But here's the thing. The Senecas didn't give up any of the land title. The city of Salamanca still exists on Seneca land. And in fact, all of the non-Senecas who live on any of those parcels have to pay a lease to the Seneca Nation. And that gets distributed to the Seneca people. So the underlying title of the city of Salamanca never left Seneca, Seneca title, original title. And in fact, if a Seneca buys, or I would say more purchases, the leasehold improvements of any of those parcels, if they take over a property there, they just don't pay anything to, they don't pay a lease back to their nation, and they don't pay any municipal taxes. it doesn't bode well for the city of Salamanca as far as a funded municipality, but the Senecas didn't get screwed out of the deal. They still own the land. And with that settlement money, by the way, that $60 million they got, it was written into their deal that they could use that fund, those funds, to buy other properties that were not a part of Salamanca or were not a part of this settlement deal. So they could buy any lands in their ancestral land area. And that's how they have three casinos that are not located on what was originally designated or recognized as their land. So they bought additional property that was kind of outside the Seneca Nation's boundaries in the Salamanca area, and they have a casino there. They bought property in Buffalo and Niagara Falls. And they did it all through this process that was not a fee-to trust process. It was a streamlined process that came about through an act of Congress. And, you know, and the reason I bring that up also is because one of the things in their MOU, in their whereas section, they talked about the fact that the Oneidas lost their case in the city of Sherrill versus the Oneida Nation. And for those that don't recall, in that case, the liberal darling of the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, not only ruled against the Oneidas, but she wrote the opinion. She included in footnote number one the doctrine of discovery. She also said that the Oneidas could not take that land off of the tax rolls of the city of Sherrill because of what she called the doctrine of impossibility. So let me be clear. She cites in her footnotes the doctrine of discovery, and then she cites also this idea of the doctrine of impossibility. Both of those were wrong citations, both of them. For one thing, it's clear that in spite of the doctrine of discovery coming through this case in the 1800s, where Chief Justice Marshall cites this and codifies it into law, he said that we couldn't hold title to the land. 30 years prior, we had the Canandaigua Treaty that was, you know, kind of imposed upon us, where the United States says, we recognize the land is yours and we'll never claim the same. That included the Oneidas. So there's no way in hell that the doctrine of discovery ever should have been used for against the Oneidas or the Senecas or Mohawks or any of us, really. I mean, maybe that was codified in the law for other territories, but we had specific language in a treaty that we didn't write that said, well, we acknowledge that the land is yours and we will never claim the same. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg was wrong. I'll tell you where else she was wrong. She was also wrong on the doctrine of impossibility, because the doctrine of impossibility, as she wrote it, was based on a claim out west that was already 150 years old, but it involved lands that the Sioux had tried to reacquire. And there and then, so 1,500 miles away, 150 years earlier, a court basically said, no, it's impossible. Even if you were cheated out of that land, it's impossible for you to now claim jurisdictional control over that land once you've lost it, even if you lost it illegitimately. So she cited that doctrine of impossibility against the Oneidas, ignoring the fact that only 15 years prior, the Senecas had this specific land claims or land acquisition clause of the Salamanca Lee Settlement Act that says, oh yeah, you can get land back. You can purchase your land back. We've even given you funds to do it. And that land would revert back to your original title and your original control over that land. So two of the things she cites, one in a footnote and one in the body of her text, were categorically wrong. And these guys in their MOU with the state made it sound like, oh, whereas the Oneidas lost in their case. It's almost like, whereas you already have our backs against the wall. They should have challenged that. So again, I view these issues not in a unique way, but in a way that I have the research that I've done, not on their deals, but on the historical significance of things. I mean, I know some of this stuff because the Longhouse that I am associated with up there put together a research team to pull all of their data, all of their agreements, including their MOU and their land claim settlement proposal, all of it. I had one of the main elected chiefs on the St. Regis Mohawk tribe after I did the podcast. His name is Jim Ransom. And he said, well, I listened to John Keane's podcast, and he was clearly misinformed. He suggested that I was relying on researchers who had came to false conclusions about what these councils had done. Now, I didn't cite any conclusions from the researchers. I had the document in my hand, and I've read it, but I wasn't reading any of their conclusions. I was reading the letters, the information that came from the band council, the tribal council, and to a lesser extent, this Longhouse representative. So he was trying to say that I was misrepresenting, and he talked a lot about trust land and how, oh no, they were going to have reservation status. Well, like I said in the beginning, 90%, if not 99% of all lands that the federal government recognizes as Indian country and reservation status are trust lands. So these guys, and it wasn't just Jim, it was somebody else who's been on council for many, many years, who kept trying to cite, well, we're getting reservation status. Only on the land they're getting back, by the way. And it's not a guarantee that they're getting even all of the land that is potentially returnable, because they can only get land back that white people are willing to come off of. So, you know, obviously they're going to have to pay, you know, higher than market value for lands in an area that, I'm not saying the land isn't valuable. I mean, all land is valuable, and especially to us. But, I mean, this is the kind of situation. So they're trying to rush through. What's going to happen on May 8th is that this tri-council is supposed to have had all of the disputes worked out with Franklin County, the St. Lawrence County, with the New York Power Authority. And again, I didn't even get into that, and I don't know they will, but they're another party of this, and with New York State. They're supposed to be able to, all these groups, all of the parties are supposed to submit their approvals to a court for what ultimately will, which should be a sanctioned settlement by July. The problem is most of the stuff isn't true, or a lot of it isn't true, especially the approvals part. So that's why I'm working with not just the one Longhouse, but frankly, even some of the Longhouse people from the other Longhouse. They may not be fans of my work, but they know what I'm saying is true. And we had, like I said, almost 4,000 people listening into the last week's podcast from Akwesasne. It is up as a YouTube video, so now it's starting to gain some traction there. It's been up as a podcast and, you know, has another 500 or 600 people that have heard that podcast. So I didn't even get into the details. I just raised the general objections to a land claim settlement, one that extinguishes claim, one that puts land in trust because we are apparently too incompetent to hold absolute and original title to our own lands. And that language isn't in any of these agreements. No place in the agreement does say that we will have absolute or original title to the lands that are returned. And to me, that's a problem. So I wanted to do this show to give you a little bit more information on what I kind of teased last week and to explain what I've been doing. I will probably go back up to Akwesasne and do another podcast on my Let's Talk Native podcast. So I encourage you, if you listen to me on the radio, if you listen to Resistance Radio, please do check out my Let's Talk Native podcast. And, you know, and like I said, in some occasions I put these things up as a video. Last week, my Resistance Radio show, I couldn't do a video for because Facebook had changed some parameter or something like that. And anyway, but I got it worked out. I'm doing it this week. So I hope if you watch this show or if you've heard this show, you will also check out my Let's Talk Native podcast. And I hope that you'll become a little bit more aware. I mean, you can research this stuff. You'll see some of the stuff that's out there. You can actually go to the St. Regis Mohawk Tribal Council's website. They've got some frequently asked questions with some pretty poor answers. And they got maps and that kind of stuff. But I will be talking about this for a while yet. So don't be surprised if I don't come back to this subject in the next few weeks, especially as it looks like they're going to try to jam this thing through. I'll kind of keep you updated on how successful we are at killing this deal, or at least, you know, putting it aside for now. I'll keep you posted. So I want to thank you for listening to this program. I want to thank you for again, supporting this program on WBAI and WPFW. Encourage you to do more. We do have our backs against the wall, as we usually do. So please support WBAI and WPFW. And I look forward to talking to you again. I'm John Cain, and this is Resistance Radio. Yahweh.